Welcome to Audio Gyan with Kedar Nimkar, a podcast that documents insightful conversations with Indian designers, artists, musicians, writers, thinkers, and creatives of all types. Catch us on iTunes or visit audiogyan.com for more Gyan sessions. Here's your host, Kedar Nimkar.
This is my rendition inspired from Pula Deshpande's Batatachi Chaal. Mrs. Lele exactly knew how much dal is left in Mrs. Oak's house after the evening supper because she could walk into their house anytime while the dinner continued. Today, Mrs. Nimkar WhatsApped Mrs. Joshi, both living in Neelkan Heights, to ask if she is free for a quick chat. Only upon getting the blue tick and yes from Mrs. Joshi, Mrs. Nimkar will go to their house, and let me tell you, even now, Mrs. Joshi will first look into the keyhole before opening the door. Trust, privacy, security, and many such words have got a different meaning in the coming decades as we move from chawls to high-rises. Well, to discuss this and more about chawls and urban culture and their design, today I have Rupali Gupte with us on AudioGAN. Rupali is an architect and co-founder of Bard Studio in Mumbai. Her work includes research on Indian urbanism with focus on architecture, urban culture, urban economy, property, housing, urban forms, entrepreneurial and tactical practices. Rupali is also the founding member of Urban Research Network, CRIT, and School of Environment and Architecture. So thank you, Rupali, for giving your time, and it's a real, real honor to have you on AudioGAN.
Thanks, Kedar, for inviting me. I'm so happy to be here.
So I've kept the topic as chawls of Mumbai, and there's also like an interesting paper which you had written from where I got some ideas to ask you a few questions around it, and hoping to document those in this session. So the first thing, if we can start and if you can set the context, there seems to be like two fascinating speculations about the word chawl. Like, how did it originate? If you can tell about that, and then we can explore more options.
Yeah, so there are many speculations about the origin of the word chawl and the origin of the type chawl itself. One of the speculations is that perhaps it must have emerged from military barracks, right? A military barracks, which were one of the early forms of housing. Typically, these are single rooms that are tied together with a corridor. So that could be one of the ways in which the chawl could have emerged. The other speculation is that it must have emerged from the agrarian vada, the typical house of an agricultural setting, which is called vada, which is predominant in Maharashtra. And perhaps that could be one of the genealogies of the chawl as well, where some of these wadas did exist in Mumbai as these agricultural forms. And when traders started coming in with the mercantile colonial economy, some of them required housing, and it must have been that the farmers and the plantation owners rented out individual rooms from this wada to the incoming people. So that could also be this. And then this vada in some ways becomes multi-tenanted. So that could be another reason, in some ways for the chawl to emerge. But there are other kind of specifications, you know, there are other significations of the chawl. For example, the chawl is also a common street in front of a house. Or in Marathi, it's also called the chaal or the sieve. And we have instances of warehouses. Even today, you find some of these warehouses near Nashik, which store onions. And the walls of these warehouses are like trellises, so literally like sieves. So that could also be, in some ways, the kind of origin of the chawl. So we really don't know exactly, but there are many of these speculations in the way the chawl could have emerged.
I was also reading about chawl. In Marathi, it also means to filter, right? Is there a connection between the filtered or the elite used to remain separately, and the residue used to be the residue as in like the kind of people used to stay here? Is that one of the speculations?
Not at all, actually. Not at all. A filter, when you say the sieve, yes, you know, the chawl or the sieve, But not in terms of filtering people, because the chawl, remember that it is, you know, I mean, this is before the apartment comes into the picture. So the chawl is predominantly a middle class urban form. Everybody lived in chawls. Okay. And there are two kinds of chawls. One is, this is almost for 300 years, you had the chawl as the predominant urban housing type. For all kinds of people, from traders in the beginning with the mercantile economy, to later with industrial housing, when you required housing for workers, you had the mill owners actually setting up these kind of houses for workers, for the mill workers. But before that, it's the traders, remember, who are living in this kind of housing, not in any ways filtering any kind of, you know, it's much later that with the apartment, the idea of housing, you know, shifts to, you know, our entire imagination shifts to apartments only later. Apartments come into the picture in Mumbai only in the 1920s. And so in some ways, the chawl was the predominant urban housing type in Mumbai.
How would you describe a chawl? I mean, like... is it like a public space or a private space when it emerged, and then later on from 1920s and what we have today? So is there any pattern?
Yeah. So I mean, just to kind of step back a little bit, you know, the whole idea of type in architecture is very important. No? Type in architecture is a generic form of a building. So for example, you would have a bungalow type, or you have the row house or the apartment type. So the chawl is a very specific type. And if you kind of describe it in its most basic form, it is a series of rooms that are tied together with a corridor. And most of the times the toilets are common. They're shared toilets. They're outside the house. But then, I mean, this is the most basic type, but then there are variations of this type. So for example, sometimes you would have a corridor on one side of the chawl. Sometimes you would have a front corridor and a back corridor. Sometimes you would have this configured around a courtyard. So there's a kind of hole in the center, you know, this courtyard in the center, and the chawl is actually wrapping around the courtyard. Sometimes you had long bars and two bars, which were then connected. The corridors on both the sides are connected with series of bridges. So there's series of variations of this type of housing. But what is most interesting in that is that the common spaces, these corridors, the bridges, actually become this idea of semi-public or semi-private kinds of spaces when your house is actually much smaller. It's a smaller space. And these then become these extended ideas of home. And you'll find a lot of people then hanging around in these spaces. And in some ways, what happens then is that the whole building starts becoming one house, you know. So the whole idea of a house being a kind of property that is relegated to just the private space of the family is somehow blurred, you know. And you, in some ways, it becomes a kind of extended idea of the home, where the people who are staying with you in some ways become an extended family. So it's interesting that this particular type allows this kind of blurring of the public and the private. And, you know, I mean, it's also kind of interesting to think of how then the traders lived, or even the mill workers. In some ways, the history of mill workers inhabiting the chawl is actually also quite interesting, because in some ways there used to be almost 12 to 15 people sometimes sharing one room. And this is the early days of the mills. In Mumbai, when the mill workers came from Konkan and other parts of the hinterland and did not actually come with families. So they were generally single men who lived and shared this small single tenement. And the way they would actually manage to do that is that there were shifts in the mills, right? That there would be three shifts. And that's how they were able to share. So many people were able to share the place. But imagine what would happen on days of common holidays, or even on days of strikes, when all the all the workers would be in one place. And that's when they would sort of start inhabiting all these external spaces, the corridors, the bridges. and you know, in some ways, a kind of culture evolves, which is very different from this kind of privatized living that we see now. And an entire urban culture evolves out of then this kind of idea of blurring the boundaries of the public and private. A lot of people spend time outside, and that's when you have, you know, urban culture evolving. You have cinema and you have theater and all kinds of things evolving. And that was a very, very rich culture in Maharashtra at this time. So what is interesting is that this particular urban type, in some ways, we could say, you know, give rise to this kind of larger urban culture. And even today, you would see that, you know, the way people actually live, there are a lot of redevelopments going on now. But people actually prefer, many people prefer to live in these settings because of this idea that, you know, that in some ways it is not a privatized life that you're living, but it's a kind of communitarian sort of life that you kind of live. And this particular typology allows for that form of life and living.
Very interesting. So when you mention that there are subtypes in like a chawl, you also speak about porosity. So is it that the chawl types which have two verandas, like two bridges, one in the front and back, like, is there any pattern between how porous the houses are?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's it's very interesting, because again, as opposed to the apartment, where once you are inside the house, you're, you know, you lock the door and you're inside, you know, this particular specification of the way the house is configured, you know, when you have a corridor in the front and you have a corridor at the back, most of the times the doors on either sides are kept open. And so you will find people walking in and out of the house, you know, and that's what we call a porous, people to actually, visitors to come in without any apprehension. And, you know, there's a very interesting case. I recently visited the Poonawalla Chawl in Parel. And there was an old couple who was staying in one of those houses. And the old gentleman there was ill. He was bedridden almost for 3 years. But it was possible for him to be like that because of this porosity, because he would have visitors coming in and out. And that's what is interesting in when you do not have state social security, you require a community to kind of support you. And this form of housing then, you know, allows that kind of porosity. It allows that form of living. And this particular, in Poonawalla Chawl itself, there's some very interesting details that kind of, you know, also in some ways talk about this porosity. So for example, there was the outer door, you know, the kind of what you would call typically the main door of the house, you know, that door actually worked in such a way that it closed off the room, that the tenement, from the outside, but that same door also was shut the kitchen cabinet. So through the day the kitchen cabinet was closed and the outside door would remain open. Okay, and it was only in the night when the same door that closed the kitchen cabinet would swivel around and close the outside, you know. And it's kind of a very interesting detail. And there's, you know, the artist Duchamp actually had a detail like that, where he had worked out, you know, the same door kind of having hinges in a particular way so that the door actually shuts two rooms at the same time and you don't have to have two doors. And in some ways, it also shows the ingenuity of people in the way that, you know, these kind of very clever tactical details are you know, configured. But what is also interesting then is that this particular detail also shows that the house, remains porous, that the inhabitants kind of have detailed the house in such a way that they want the outside to kind of remain open to outsiders, to be able to walk in and out whenever. And in some ways that also gives you a form of security, and you do not have to then close the door. So the idea of security is very different. There's no fear of theft. But on the other hand, security comes from, you know, knowing that your neighbor can walk into your house at any point and, you know, you will not be left alone. And, you know, you will, even as old people, you would not sort of, you know, die of loneliness. So yeah, that's actually what is interesting about this whole idea of porosity in the house.
Mm-hmm. But did it conflict with privacy? Because, or is this privacy like a more urban phenomena?
So the thing is, yes, now in many ways, privacy is something that the younger people cherish, right? Mm-hmm. The younger people in some ways do try to escape from this idea of being watched and sort of, you know, find their own spaces. So even in the Chawls, I know some of my thesis students are doing studies on Chawls and they're trying to figure out how it is that younger people, you know, in some ways make homes, for themselves, configure their own sort of private spaces in the space of the Chawl. But what is, you know, interesting is that this kind of idea of privacy and sort of, you know, publicness or this idea of a security that comes from a larger community, something that becomes very specific, especially in contemporary Mumbai. I mean, just kind of to look at what some of the statistics of, you know, who is going to inhabit or who is inhabiting the city and who is going to be inhabiting the city soon. If you look at very closely the growth of the city is not really growing that much. It is growing less than the national average is. Mm-hmm. People are not coming, new people are not coming to the city because, you know, it's expensive. There are not no new jobs in the city. And so the city in the next 20 years is going to become the city of the old. Okay. Hmm. And this is very important for us to think about because more and more you're redeveloping your properties. You are turning these older urban forms into high-rise apartments where you will have the old actually trapped into these apartments. And kind of all kinds of things from mental health to all kinds of issues will start popping up. And what is important is that you have to really look very carefully at the demographies of your city. On the other hand, you also look at, you know, again, the fact that if new jobs are not coming in terms of the way we've understood the city always as this financial capital, it's not going to remain a financial capital anymore. But what you see actually is that it's a cultural capital. You know, so you have all kinds of jobs that will come in that are more media related and all kinds of things. So again, you'll require very, very different kinds of housing. And today you're seeing, you know, co-working spaces coming up tomorrow. You know, very soon you're going to have to also look at the idea of co-living, you know, along with co-working. And these Chawls in many ways become very interesting types to think of this contemporary form of living, where you're able to share resources, where you can, you know, actually kind of, you're not consuming a lot of resources, so you don't have large apartments, but you have smaller tenements with a lot of common spaces, which, you know, become in some ways resources for you. So it's possible to think, I mean, definitely there is a compromise in privacy in the older form of the Chawl, but it's also possible to kind of start thinking of retrofitting these Chawls. So for example, common toilets are the ones that are the most, affect privacy the most, but it's possible to kind of work with this idea of a communitarian form of living by retrofitting, for example, toilets inside your house. You know, it's possible to retrofit the apartment, I mean, the tenement itself to have, you know, furniture which is able to, multiply and also create these ideas of privacy. You also have very interesting heights in these spaces, and it's also possible to work with lofts and other things that are possible to configure privacy. So in that sense, you know, privacy is something that can be worked out. But what is important is that we shouldn't be losing some of the communitarian spirit that this type actually provides.
So I'll come back to this point. I just had one more thing. So Mumbai as a city has its own character just because the Chawls were predominant form of living. I have this personal judgment about Mumbai is being so tolerant, either because people are oblivious of what's happening around them and they are just on their own zone, or then it has been built by patients, like standing in front of these common chawl toilets.
Yeah. See, I'm not saying, I don't think we need to romanticize common toilets, mm-hmm. you know. That's a kind of infrastructure that is important to retrofit and provide, you know. In some ways, it's having toilets inside the house is a form of dignity. You don't have to stand in lines outside waiting to go to a toilet, you know.
Sorry to interrupt, but what I want to understand is because of this style of living, we have built patience. So there are always trade-offs, right? So you get things inside, you have more security, you have hygiene, you have your dignity, but when not just toilets but different sorts of common living spaces build in more more rapport between the people living
absolutely.
So if you can share any insights there.
So absolutely, you know, when you began with this idea that, you know, does the chawl actually lend any character to the city, it absolutely does. And, you know, it's the chawl is, again, a predominantly urban form, you know, as opposed to other forms, which are perhaps, you know, apartments or others, which tend to become insular, you know. So in some ways, you will find that the chawl is also configured most of the times in ways that, because these are longer types, they face streets, and in some ways, increase the number of transactions that one can actually have with the street. You know, as opposed to being closed into a compound wall and becoming insular. And so in that sense, it's not only porosity between the house and the common spaces, but it's also porosity with the city. So often you will find that the tenements, the internal spaces are buffered with these long verandas or corridors that face the city. And they become a place where you can sit and actually watch the whole kind of drama of the city unfold. But in some ways, you're also watching the city. And so there's the eyes on the street, you know, which the famous line that Jane Jacobs sort of, you know, brought to us, this idea of eyes on the street, which makes the street a secure space, you know. And more and more you see that when these chawls are getting redeveloped, they're turning into the high-rise towers. But also you have other norms like parking and other things that have come into the picture. So even, you know, up to a ground and seven stories, you have parking now, you know. So the city is going to become more and more characterless. You know, it's going to become more and more unwalkable because you have suddenly these kind of stacks of parking and cars keeping on coming down because you do not have adequate infrastructure. No, your streets are not wide enough for these cars to come down. They're not walkable anymore because now you're surrounded by cars as opposed to what you were surrounded by earlier, you know, these kind of verandas on the street where people would look out, you know, into. And so this whole idea of the urban character is something that the chawl actually provided in a very, very rich way. But that's something that is kind of, you know, being compromised in some ways by other forms of kind of dwelling, which are becoming more and more insular and taking away some of the character of the city. And, you know, I mean, just to kind of also come back to this idea that, like, the city's character actually was built through so many, many different kinds of housing, you know, from site and services schemes to the chawls, to the row houses, and so many other forms of life and living have actually made the city and its character. But today, somehow, you know, the apartment has kind of hijacked our own sort of, you know, imagination. And it's not only the apartments, even the early apartments were, you know, walk-ups, and those were also nice spaces. But today, the only kind of imagination is the high-rise with, like I just said, stacked parking that goes up to seven stories and, you know, where you're kind of living a life which is turning your back to the city in many ways.
But being a financial capital, I think, is it fair to say it's inevitable? The question is mainly, like, can elites stay in chawl?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's the thing that I also kind of, in some ways, answer a little bit, in the sense that not going to remain that financial capital that it was. you know. So it's very important to speculate on where the city is going and plan accordingly. You know, I mean, because what happens is, you know, in the last development plan, there was such a generic idea of everyone requires 9 square meter space, you know. But who is this everybody? Who is going to inhabit the city in the future? Where is your economy going? You know, who are these elites that are going to be occupying the city? I think these are questions that have to be looked at very, very closely. And I think that's where your, you know, the whole idea that in the future, your city, you have to promote your cultural economy. That's where your city is moving towards. It's moving towards a cultural economy where in some ways it's media, it's, you know, design and other things that are taking over your you know, businesses. And so you would require spaces for that. Who are these elite, you know? Who are these elite? It's the people who are, you know, going to be occupying, the people who, like for example, you saw the co-working spaces. They've come up because they're answering the market demand where you know that people can no longer afford, large offices, which is why you have these very interesting new forms of collective where people are sharing office spaces, right? And they're sharing resources. Now, one has to really think about in the future, what are these, you know, who are we building these large apartments for? Today, if you see, half the housing that you build, which is speculative housing, is empty. You know, you have billboards. I to say that, you know, developers are in trouble today because there's only imagination that they've thought is that to thought about is to kind of make houses for the elite, you know. But most of your city is not able to afford it. And you're seeing it right now. Developers have some kind of holding capacity, so they're holding on to the stocks. But you can see this is the first time that we're seeing billboards with the prices of housing in Mumbai. Had you ever seen that? You know, that you have developers actually kind of quoting the price on the cities. You never saw that before. Who is this? Who are these elite? And, you know, who are you building for? And start becoming much, much more specific in the ways you actually start looking at the demands, you know, for housing and how they can be met. Because otherwise, you're going to have a bubble that is just waiting to burst.
Mm-hmm. So how would one go about? I mean, these architecture types are to be designed based on people, or then people will inhabit in the way they want it. Like, how does that dynamic will work?
So that, like, you know, like I said, there have been, even in this city, in Mumbai itself, we've had so many different kinds of delivery systems of housing. The developer today has become the inevitable, service provider. But the developer, you know, if you historicize it a little bit, the developer was not always in the picture. You had in the 70s, a very strong cooperative housing society movement, you know, where the government would lease land to groups of people who would come together from all, you know, all walks of life. And then they would, you know, they would hire a contractor and an architect and they would actually build their own housing, you know. So that's a possibility to kind of start thinking about, you know, is it possible to think of new forms of cooperatives that can, you know, think for themselves, build kind of housing for themselves? The other is the idea of redevelopment, which is, you know, big today. The thing is, the middle class is kind of, you know, almost becoming greedier and greedier. And there was a time that at some point, you know, developers kind of came in and gave so many sops that you just kind of sat and waited for free housing, you know, and this would be kind of built out of subsidies. So the sale component that kind of came in would give you free housing. But today, again, you're not seeing that happening anymore. And you see so many projects that have stalled, you know. One way, again, to think about is that there could be soft loans that people could get and, you know, to redevelop their houses. And not in ways that, you know, that you kind of build these most unsustainable high rises. I mean, think about it. When you're building those kind of high rises, you're also paying huge maintenance charges. And correct. How many people can afford those maintenance charges? You know, and at some point when those maintenance charges rise, you know, if you're older, you're on pension, you will not be able to afford those kind of charges. And slowly you would, you know, you would sell that and you would leave. So there's a kind of soft eviction that happens through, you know, these kind of typologies. So you will really have to come back to other forms of more sustainable housing to, you know, to able to live in the city for a really long time, you know. And the third thing I would say again is the idea of repair and retrofit. Again, that is a very, very important model, because again, we only think of building anew, but there's so much very, very interesting housing stock in the city that has given rise to a kind of form of life and living, which has, like I've said in the, you know, before, generated a certain kind of urban culture. And so it is possible to even think of repairing and retrofitting. There was at some point, there was, for the Chawls particularly, there was a tax that was collected by the government called the cess tax. You had MADA coming in. There was a repair board that was set up that repaired those houses. But in some ways, a very shoddy job of that was done. You know, many times you saw this very nice wood of the Chawls would be sold and would be replaced by, you know, struts, metal struts that are not very nice, that, you know, kind of take away from the, in many ways, the kind of beauty of the Chawls, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But in some ways, I think if we bring back this idea of repair and retrofit very seriously, you know, the government sort of also takes heed of it, pays heed to it, and brings it back in some ways, that's another way in which we can actually think of repairing, retrofitting, where both, you know, residents, the government also in some ways contributes to, you know, thinking of somehow a kind of larger idea of bringing back some of these typologies and repairing and retrofitting them and making them available for contemporary use.
But then why do you think government or some authoritative body need to come and let the people itself decide? So I saw your talk at WID and a few of the installations which you had shown in Venice Biennale, I believe also. So there people are designing and building their own ecosystem just probably 3 feet within their 3 feet distance. So if given that freedom, people can design their own stuff as well, right? So why someone else have to how can I unlock this? Yeah.
Right. No, I think, I mean, what I'm saying is that we need to think about it on various registers, you know, like for example, redevelopment of your existing Chawls would be in your hands, you know, like where the tenant comes in, where the landlord comes in and others, and in some ways, many stakeholders are in the, you know, in the picture. And particularly when it comes to things like cooperative societies and other things, when it's completely in the hands of people, it is possible for people to come in and say, we do not want the developer, or we kind of start thinking of reconfiguring their houses where they take charge and not let the developer sort of take over, you know. So in some ways, and you're seeing that in many places, this whole idea of self-development is coming in a big way. There have been examples of people actually doing that. But in some ways, I think even when they're doing that, this whole idea of type and typology is something that is very, very important, and people don't understand often the value of space and what it can do to kind of enhance their life and living. So again, I know that has to come back into discussion in a big, big way, you know, within the public as well. But, you know, it's when it comes to people who cannot afford, and the rent played a big, big role in this, post 1947, you know, the rents were frozen. We had the Rent Control Act that came in. Many people are, you know, upset with it, but in some ways it also allowed people, you know, to survive in those spaces, people who could not have afforded, And this is where, you know, government, I mean, really kind of housing is something which is today seen as something that is speculative. But housing is also in some ways a right, no? So I think it's important at different registers for, you know, that's where the government tries to come in and facilitate housing. And that's something we've seen up to the 90s, you know, mid 80s, actually, the government was a provider of housing and they provided housing to many, many low income groups and other things. In the 90s, the government started taking a backseat. It became a facilitator of housing as opposed to the provider that it was. And that's when it kind of opened up all these various policies where they started giving incentives to developers, you know, and in their own, even their own authorities. If you are, you're a Maharashtra Housing and Area Development Authority, you should be actually setting the pace, you know, setting the terms for housing. But in some ways, they also started acting like developers, you know. So I think it's important to have a way in which you kind of also think of housing for all kinds of people, you know, people who can afford, but people who can't afford is very important. And that's where the government needs to take some kind of, you know, play some kind of role as well.
I mean, it's such huge and such vast. I can't, like, I'm not like in a position to ask more nuanced questions, but just as a like a layman question, and which has been troubling me a lot, especially in the Bombay context, that if you look at the way high rises are being built, and there are these certain norms which the government has put in that you have to have like the staircase of this width so that the stretcher can at least go down and go up. Those kind of basic norms are also not being followed. So, I mean, this is slightly off, but if you can help me understand how come the roads are not big enough to handle these huge accommodations in high rises, and yet they are not designed as the way they should be. So what's going wrong, if you can help me understand?
So again, I think one, the instances that you're talking about are in many cases, this is again, part of the facilitation that the government did. And a lot of these came from actually redevelopments of chawls. This is that we had 19,000 chawl houses in the city, which were, you know, up for redevelopment. And one of the things that the government did was that it relaxed some of the norms of setbacks, so that you could, you know, so that it became in some ways profitable for the developer to build. And so in many cases, you must have seen, particularly in the inner city of Mumbai, like in South Bombay, there are towers which are very close to each other with very small distances between them. And that is because norms of setbacks and light and ventilation were relaxed. And this also happens actually in the slum redevelopments. So you will see today, even, I mean, sometimes you see 24-storied buildings with only 3-meter distances between them. And again, this was one of the policies of the government where these norms were relaxed so that incentives could be given to developers, you know. And I mean, in some ways, it was also the fire tender also couldn't come in because you did not have enough space for, you know, the fire tender to move in because these regulations were relaxed. So I think this is, again, something that is part of the facilitation, you know. Rather, so you're facilitating rather than thinking about what infrastructure already exists and then what you would allow, you know, in terms of whether you could allow a high rise or not. So I think, which is why you need to switch, you need to change the ways you look at, you know, you can't build on the supply side. You have to kind of start thinking of what does it mean to think of what is the demand actually, you know, what would actually be required. And for example, I mean, very simple case, we kind of, the norm of parking, for example, no, that the fact that you have to have so many number of parking spots, And then you kind of come give rise to these high parking towers in the lower stories of your building with no regard to the size of the road that you have in front of you. You know,
correct.
These are all very, very myopic policies. But on the other hand, you know, I when you're thinking of planning the city, again, you have to start thinking of a larger strategy. You really need to think of public transport, for example, where people are disincentivized for having cars. You know, you cannot run a city where you start thinking of every single individual having their own cars. Your cities at this scale just won't work, you know. So instead of looking at myopic policies where you're forced to get people to the developers to have parking spots inside, you disincentivize people for having cars, you know, and then you kind of facilitate a kind of urban form which provides a kind of rich cultural life to the city. You provide for very good public transport which dignifies people's lives. You know, so even if I can afford to have a car, I should not want to have a car because my life is much nicer without the car. You know, I can walk in the city. I'll be a healthier person if I could do that. You know, so I think the way we are kind of looking at many of our solutions are extremely myopic. You really have to step back and look at a larger way in which you kind of think of city culture.
Definitely. I think, I mean, like, I have like many questions around that, but just to keep the CHOL concept back, I wanted to ask you last two questions. One is, so these general norms, these were considered while designing these CHOLs, or CHOLs were like really organic spaces?
So in many cases, they came much more organically, but in the sense that, for example, because these rooms are small, you have the corridors which become wider, you know. And so these did come organically. And it's interesting today to come back and study those, because what happens later is when the FSI norm comes in, you know, the floor space index norms come in, you start having the urban form taking a backseat. And then it becomes a numeric logic, you know. So when though the CHOLs are organically developing, there is the idea of thinking of the type, you know, the type which is important in terms of the way it would face the street, for example, how tall it would be, what would be, you know, what would be the context of it. And all of these, and what is, you know, in many countries called form-based codes, that you think of the urban form of a city carefully, is something that has been thought of, you know, in recent times. But we have, some of the norms of building regulations that we have are extremely generic, which do not in any ways focus on urban form. And to think that, you know, urban form gives rise to a particular kind of form of life and living is something that is very important. So I think today we really have to come back, even if we if these have come up organically, it will be interesting to analyze where, you know, what these have generated and what kind of building regulations would come, you know, bring back some of this kind of, experience of city living which some of these older types gave us. Because clearly, many of the new types that have come out through generic norms of floor space index and the way we are kind of building these insular types through compound walls and other things is not, you know, it's kind of making your city life quite poor. And that's why you'll see a lot of the way the suburbs have grown are very different from the way, if you walk into some of the streets of Bhuleshwar and Kalba Devi and others, it's right now it's the traffic congestion that has taken over, but the city life actually is much, much richer there than, you know, some of the generic ways in which the suburbs have developed in Mumbai.
To conclude, I have like a twofold question. Like, if you have to envision like Mumbai in 2050, like one is based on your research, based on your analysis, based on your experience of what you've been studying, what do you think is the future like? And one is, what do you would like it to be? and if obviously CHOLs exist in some shape and form as a type, not necessarily the architecture, but how would they look like?
I mean, the way the development is going right now, chawls may not exist,
You mean to say chawl as a concept also?
As a concept also, the way, I mean, because that's what I'm saying, that, we aren't paying attention to the cultural life that it is generating. You know, we are working very through kind of numeric logics, profits that are generated. But the thing is, like we've seen that the economy has, in some ways is tanking. No, we've seen it around. And these redevelopments are not happening. And so that's really what you can see the curve, you can see that kind of drop. And in some ways, we probably is also interestingly the hope, that your city will not go that way because it's not going to, the economy itself is not going to sustain in that direction, And so in many ways, we will have to start thinking of alternatives. We will have to start thinking of other forms in which we live our lives. And I would say that the chawl would be definitely one of the types that will need to come back, in its contemporary form, in its kind of retrofitted form, in a contemporary form. We will have to kind of, because that's the only way in which you will have to start looking at a much more sustainable form of living. So I'm kind of hopeful, I'm hopeful because I'm seeing this kind of, there was this rampant redevelopment that was happening around, and that redevelopment would actually completely destroy your city life, But it's like, I'm also hopeful because, like, I'm seeing these forms of sort of, like the co-working spaces and others that are emerging, that people are going to realize very soon that we require a different form of living. And so these will come back, And I would say that architects, developers, all kinds of people, planners, everyone who has some stakes of, thinking of the city, even economists, I think have to in some ways come back and think a little more sensitively, a little more, in a little more nuanced way, to think of where your city is going, and to bring back some of these models in new contemporary ways. I'm not saying romanticize the older forms and say that, this is the only way. And we've seen this in many places that, cities have been retrofitted and modernized with all the infrastructure for contemporary living, but learning from older types, And I think that is something that we cannot shy away from. It's very important for us to think about, because that's the only way to think of the future.
But then how would these policies be designed? Let them be open-ended and people decide, or again, it will be pushed down our throats from some bodies?
No, you will have to do some, you will have to do some lobbying. The government is us, it's a democracy, So in some ways, you at various levels, we will need to lobby as all kinds of things, as citizens, as professionals, So we will have to become active in thinking of how the policies are being shaped. Even when you have a development plan, you have suggestions and objections that are there, So in some ways, citizens participate in many ways.
I think that's a very positive note. And frankly, I have like many questions, but just given the time we have, I would definitely like to have you again on AudioGAN, ask more questions, understand how the urban setting is changing and what's the future like. Cool. Thank you. Thank you, Rupali, for giving your time. It was really wonderful talking to you.
Thanks so much. Bye.
And that's it from today's Gyan session. Catch us on iTunes, Saavn, Stitcher or any podcasting app you use. Do rate us on iTunes and follow us on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram. Stay tuned for more Gyan on audiogyan.com. Till then, bye.